Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast, your source for current issues within the legal practice. Today, the Federalist Society's Federalism and Separation of Powers Practice Group is hosting a panel debate discussion on the government's duty to defend federal law. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speakers. My name is Dean Reuter, Director of the Practice Groups, and I'm happy to welcome you to today's podcast. We have three podcasters joining us today. We'll hear first from Walter Dellinger. He's chair of the appellate practice at O'Melveny & Myers. And then we'll hear from Professor John Eastman. He's the Donald P. Kennedy Chair in Law, Director, Center for Constitutional Jurisprudence, and former dean of Chapman University Law School. Finally, we'll hear from Professor John Baker. He's the Dale E. Bennett Professor of Law, Paul M. Herbert Law Center at Louisiana State University School of Law. Each is going to give us opening remarks of 5 minutes. And I do want to point out for the listeners that our first speaker, Walter Dellinger, is the author of a New York Times editorial that ran and is available online with a date of October 21st, 2010, on our topic today. Walter, can you start us off, please?
Sure, Dean. The question that you posed today for Professors Baker and Eastman and me is one of the most difficult, I think, that recurs in every presidential administration, which is, when may the president decline to comply with an act of Congress because he believes it is unconstitutional? When may a president decline to defend an act of Congress in court in his Justice Department when he disagrees with it? It's come up recently, of course, because of the litigation over Don't Ask, Don't Tell, when a federal district court held that the discrimination against gay men and lesbians was unconstitutional. And the issue arises, well, if President Obama, who said he thinks the law ought to be repealed, is against it, why doesn't he simply tell the Justice Department not to appeal the ruling, and that's that, and it's over? Well, it's not that easy. Generally speaking, the president doesn't have the power to dispense with the law. In rare instances that I recounted in a 1994 memorandum to then White House Counsel Abner Mikva, presidents have said they don't have to comply with the law that they have conscientiously concluded is unconstitutional. But when they do that, there are a number of circumstances that have to be present. One is the president really has to have a good sense that it's very probable that the Supreme Court would agree with him. And I think we don't know how the Supreme Court would rule on Don't Ask, Don't Tell. It's also the case that a president ought to take into account some deference to the Congress that passed the law and also decide to enforce it or not enforce it, depending on which of those steps allows the court to have a say in whether the law is going to be upheld or not. Another step a president can take is to comply with the law and to nominally defend it, but have his Justice Department tell the court that they believe it's unconstitutional. There are examples going back to 1946 that are in just for the more recent history, where in United States versus Lovett, the Congress cut off the salary of three named individuals, and the Solicitor General told the court that they were going to defend against the action, and when the Court of Claims ruled in favor of the three individuals, took it up to the Court of Appeals, to the U.S. Supreme Court, but told the court, we think you should strike it down. And the court appointed counsel to argue on behalf of the constitutionality of the law. One of the more recent examples was Acting Solicitor General John G. Roberts, now known to some of you as Chief Justice Roberts, told the court that it thought a position of the Federal Communications Commission, a minority preference provision, was unconstitutional. Actually, in that instance, the court didn't agree. But in every administration, these issues have come up, and they are very, very difficult questions. I am more comfortable if the president himself makes a determination that a law is unconstitutional, suppose, for example, the president decided after consulting with the military leadership that Don't Ask, Don't Tell was actually harmful to the national security, instructing the Solicitor General to so inform the court of that view, and then allow a private counsel to be selected who would, by the court, for some amicus or for Congress itself, who would strongly argue for the constitutionality of the law while the Solicitor General argued against it. That, to me, is a less drastic step than the president simply ignoring the law. But I want to hear from Professors Baker and Eastman, because these are difficult questions, and I think there's no easy answer to what the president should do when he has his own constitutional doubts about a law he's charged with enforcing.
Terrific. Thank you, Walter Dellinger. Let's hear next from Professor John Eastman. John?
Walter, thanks very much for that opening. You've set the stage, I think, very nicely for our discussion today. And Dean and the Federalist Society, thank you for hosting this important podcast. I think I agree with everything that Walter said. These are very tough issues. And we begin currently in the 21st century from a set of propositions that I think were radically different than the founders would have begun with. We all assume that only the court will determine constitutionality. But I think for the founders, every branch of government had an independent obligation to determine constitutionality on their own. And no one of the branches had a priority in making that determination. Jefferson is famous for this. Of the court, in his view on the Alien and Sedition Acts, the court has spoken on its views of the constitutionality of those acts. I have a different view, and the exercise of my powers, I'm not going to enforce statutes that I believe to be unconstitutional. And in our constitutional scheme and alignment of things, I think as an original matter that's correct. But what we're seeing now, I think, is something different in kind. And first, most by and large have accepted that the final word on constitutional questions is going to come from the Supreme Court. And so, Walter, your comment about that one of the requirements should be that the president has a fairly good sense that the Supreme Court would agree that the law was unconstitutional before taking the fairly dramatic step of not enforcing federal law. And there's a difference, I think, also between not enforcing the law, but also not defending it against a challenge. And this becomes particularly acute when they put up a perfunctory defense, conceding points that undermine the constitutionality of the statute that no valid litigation strategy would require that you concede in order to advance a policy agenda that they don't like the law, and then try and wrap it under the guise of unconstitutionality. And when you do that, then I do think the Justice Department, the executive, the state attorney general's office, if we're talking about a defense of a state law, as is going on in California right now with Proposition 8, I do think they are being rather derelict in their duties. And by putting on the perfunctory defense, rather than coming clean and saying we agree or we think like the plaintiffs that this is unconstitutional, they prevent the court from designating someone to defend the statute so that it gets the full adversarial process and defense that it warrants. And you end up with a great opportunity for collusion.
Yes.
If you set up a system like that. And I want to focus a little bit on the Proposition 8 litigation in California, because there is evidence in the trial record of actual collusion between the Attorney General of the state, whose job it was to defend the statutes and initiatives of the state against all challenges in the courts of the land, and the plaintiffs who were seeking to challenge that. And it goes beyond just agreeing with them on the legal arguments. It actually involved coordinating responses on interrogatories so that they would have assistance in their opposition to summary judgment and what have you. And I actually think that not only does a disservice to the initiative process, but may well be a violation of ethical obligations of any attorney when he throws his nominal clients overboard in order to advance a different agenda. And this thing becomes even more acute when we're looking at states that have something that the federal government doesn't have, and that is a power of initiative that is reserved in the people, precisely to do end runs around elected officials that they don't think are doing an adequate job of representing the people of the state. And California led the way a century ago in creating an initiative that would give that additional check on the authority of government. And when you allow the government, who has just been overturned by the initiative process, to effectively have a veto by a non-defense policy on this litigation strategy, the opportunity for collusive behavior is just too great to resist temptation by many people who begin from a process of advocacy in the first place. So I do think there is a huge problem with failure to defend. And I proposed, for example, I think the pendulum goes too far the other direction when you defend every statute, no matter how clearly it looks to be unconstitutional, because you can make a colorable argument from existing Supreme Court precedent that may itself be suspect and need to be challenged. And so I've urged Solicitor Generals and others in state's Attorney General's office to consider a two-tiered brief strategy that looks at the existing precedent, offers the colorable arguments that might be made in defense of it, and then in part two sets out, well, here are the reasons why we don't believe, as the executive official equally obligated to assure compliance with the Constitution, that those arguments ultimately prevail. But at least they're out there. And if the court then determines that that they don't think those arguments are being vigorously defended, to give them the adversarial process that we rely on so much in our system of justice, then they can appoint outside counsel to take the ball even further. And that has happened. It happened recently in the Miranda warnings, the Dickerson case, where the government decided we're not going to defend this particular action, and they appointed very prominent outside counsel, and there was no one that could watch the oral arguments at the Supreme Court in that Dickerson case. I think outside counsel did not do a full and fair, adequate job, giving us the confidence that the adversarial process had worked its course.
Okay, thank you, John Eastman. John Baker, can you give us your point of view on this?
Well, I think this is going to be an example of where we're all in fundamental agreement, but with certain nuances going one way or another. I just wanted to, first of all, to comment on John Eastman's point about collusion. I think there's been collusion for a long time in the federal courts on litigation, often where a 1983 plaintiff will sue a local government or something, in particular a school board, and yes, they are happy to be sued. And I don't know that the federal courts are adequately watching over this. The appointment of outside counsel sometimes can raise standing issues, which we won't go into here. But my point on both of them, I guess, is that it has to be particularized to what exactly we're talking about. And both John and Walter have done that with references to particular instances, one Prop 8 and the other Don't Ask, Don't Tell. But let's go back to the question about whether it has to be unconstitutional. Not only does the president have the obligation to enforce the laws, but he also has a great deal of discretion. And we know, as a matter of fact, that all kinds of federal laws, because there are so many federal laws, never get enforced. And probably we have a very good example recently, although he seems to have taken it back, where Attorney General Holder basically sent the message out early on that we're really not going to enforce marijuana laws. And that is within the prerogative of the executive branch, as the president delegates that power to through the statutes to the attorney general. You can't enforce everything, so every administration is going to be, quote, selective. And this is de facto the failure to enforce certain laws as a matter of policy. And often these issues are simply never litigated, or when they are litigated, such as a criminal defendant who claims that I've been prosecuted but so-and-so has not been prosecuted, that's a defense that goes nowhere and is clearly recognized that the executive branch has a certain amount of discretion. So I think it's important to recognize that there are areas of policy disagreement where the laws really never get enforced if the executive branch chooses to do so. Probably historically, a good example would be what happened or what Nixon didn't do or what he did do regarding impoundment of funds. I mean, funds had been impounded or not spent previously, but he just made an issue of it. And when he made an issue of it, he lost on that ground. So there are different ways to get around this issue. I think it only comes up in the two instances, I mean, most prominently in the instances that John and Walter have been talking about, when it's very clear that the executive is refusing to enforce the law as it's stated, when clearly there is a great deal of support for enforcing it from some sources. I want to talk just a little bit about the states, and although John, I think, properly made a point that Prop 8 in California is an initiative and that the obligation of an attorney general would be very important in that kind of a state, I just want to mention that we've got 50 states and there are different approaches, and certainly separation of powers in the states is not what it is at the federal level. If it were, attorneys general would be appointed by state governors. The attorney general in New Jersey is, but as far as I know, in most states, the attorney general is elected. So if the attorney general is elected, he or she has a stronger obligation directly to the public that he or she would not have if appointed to the governor. It would be the governor's obligation. This raises a related question, and I've actually been involved in a situation where an attorney general refused to enforce a law, but the governor chose to enforce it and hired me to defend the law. And in that instance, it seems to me it turns on whether both the attorney general and the governor under state constitutions or other law have the authority to defend the law. If it is in fact divided between the governor and the attorney general, then if the attorney general refuses to do so, the people are not necessarily unrepresented if the governor is willing to and does do so. So that would be my contribution.
Well, thank you, John Baker. Let me ask, is there a mechanism at the federal level, is there a mechanism for Congress to defend a statute that it has duly passed that the executive refuses to defend? Are there some kind of intervener rights?
Well, there's no intervention right, because the only Article III party when a federal law would be challenged would be the United States. But there is a federal statutory requirement that if the Attorney General or the Department of Justice is not going to enforce or defend the constitutionality of an act of Congress, they must formally notify Congress of that fact. That's in 28 U.S.C. 530D requires that. There are some instances, we have a lot of agreement, but these are such difficult issues. There are actually a few instances in which I think a president is justified in refusing to comply with the law, even though it's going to be a close constitutional question. And one of those, perhaps the only one, is where that's the only way to get a judicial test of the constitutionality of a law. And I think of the mother of all of these cases, Myers versus the United States, where Congress said the president is forbidden from discharging a postmaster without the approval of the Senate, which all of us strong presidential power people think is clearly unconstitutional, certainly. In the Scalia-Rehnquist tradition, people think it's unconstitutional. The only way you're ever going to test that is for the president to say, I'm going to fire somebody without asking the Senate's approval.
Well, I think that was clearly correct for him to do so. I don't see a whole
right.
lot of problem.
Right. Well, all I'm saying is, John, it was a divided decision, so it wasn't like a slam dunk. It had been debated at the time of the Andrew Johnson impeachment. But I think it was perfectly appropriate for the president to disobey this law, even though three justices, including Holmes and Brandeis, actually dissented in Myers. In other words, it didn't have to be a slam dunk, but that's the way the president got the test, to fire Myers without the permission of the Senate. Myers sued. In that case, the government told the court that it thought the law was unconstitutional. And in other cases, in United States versus Lovett, where Congress required the cutting off of the salary of three named individuals who were thought to be subversive, and the president believed it to be unconstitutional, those three individuals sued in the Court of Claims. The Solicitor General sought certiorari and said, we agree with the Court of Claims that the law is unconstitutional. We agree with the plaintiffs. We think this court ought to resolve it.
Right.
And they informed the House and the Senate, retained counsel who appeared as amicus, basically, to argue on behalf of the constitutionality of the law, very much, I think, in the way, I believe it was Paul Cassell that argued in the Miranda case.
Yes.
When the Clinton administration believed that the law that purported to restrict Miranda was unconstitutional, counsel was allowed by the court to argue. Here's the tough question for me. You know, every solicitor general makes arguments that he or she doesn't agree with. Yeah. It's not the fact that, for example, in the year that I spent as acting solicitor general, we had to defend the Internet Decency Act, which restricted access to what was constitutionally protected, that is non-constitutionally obscene, constitutionally protected, and decent material. We thought that it was going to be struck down 9-0, and most of the provisions were struck down 9-0. I think a couple we got struck down only 7-2. We knew it was unconstitutional, but we thought Congress deserved the best shot. I was pleased that the ACLU said that we'd made them work nights, that we briefed it so vigorously. So, man, I think the obligation to defend is, in some sense, an obligation to defend vigorously. I suppose what's different is in a circumstance where the president thinks the law is bad as a matter of policy, and he believes that it is unconstitutional, and perhaps there are matters particularly within his responsibility, which none of the issues one way or the other in Internet indecency were, why it was not a kind of case where the president would say we're not going to defend it. That president, in fact, has signed it into law, so that wasn't, you know, a thinkable option. But it's hard for me to actually, I don't think that any of the solicitors general or administrations have formulated a very good set of principles for deciding when the fact that you disagree with the law and believe that it is constitutionally dubious, when does that justify the president so informing the court and even going to the step of suggestion that the court strike it down and that other counsel argue on its behalf. I don't think we have a very good system for separating cases into those two categories.
Well, I think it turns on your framework of separation of powers. I don't think, Walter, that any Solicitor General is going to be defending if there's ever a posture to defend the War Powers Act, do you think?
I think that's correct, that where a statute was thought to be unconstitutional and it infringed what the president and his law officers thought were the president's own powers, particularly in the war-making area, there I think would be an easy case that you wouldn't defend the statute before the court.
No, but you,
you
also,
would do. Go ahead, John.
Yeah, but you also would ensure that the people who did believe it was constitutional, an exercise of their power, Congress, had somebody representing them in the case to provide the adversarial advocacy that's necessary to fully test that issue. The problem I have with some of the things going on right now is there are grounds on which statutes are perfectly constitutional. The government will concede those grounds, and then the court will then say, well, the government itself has not based its position on this, and without that, we find no ground for constitutionality. And so then you're intruding on the power of Congress to pass perfectly constitutional laws when you throw them under the bus. And you're also intruding on, Professor Baker talked about earlier, about lots of laws don't get enforced, and everybody agrees that the executive has a great deal of discretion in that area. But when I use this discretion to not defend a statute that has a weak constitutional challenge up against it, and by not defending, I now create a constitutional ruling that limits the ability of any future executive to choose to exercise the discretion in a different way to enforce it, because it's now been held unconstitutional and we've settled the matter. Yeah, and I don't think we disagree, but I'm just pointing out some of the concerns, and I see it coming into play in several of the cases now, where we have governments conceding points that no staunch advocate would concede, that provide the basis for a upholding of a statute, and when they concede that point, then the thing is held to be unconstitutional, and they say, "See, we were right all along."
Well, yeah, I think the point you made about blocking someone else from taking the issue is very important. Think of the Chadha case, for instance, in which the court appointed counsel to defend the statute. I don't think they should have appointed counsel because it dealt with one particular person, and there was no case or controversy at the point when the government didn't want to deport this person. So I think you have to ask in what context. There, the failure of the government to defend the law meant that the person to be deported wouldn't have been deported, and the case wouldn't have gone anywhere had the court not appointed counsel. But it would not have precluded, in a future instance, somebody from raising the issue in a different context.
No, I think that's right. But, you know, then we can go back to the education advocacy cases that you alluded to earlier, where the teachers union will sue the school board, both seeking to get more money, and the taxpayer or the legislature who's responsible for that is not involved in the case and yet are bound by the court orders that come down.
Right.
I mean, there's a lot of work, I think, that needs to be done on necessary parties. And I think we've also lost track of the notion about injunctions that apply to people that are not parties to the case that give this opportunity for this kind of gamesmanship to go on in our trial courts or even at the Supreme Court on occasion. And by the way, Walter, I was at the court when you argued and you did do a first-rate job, and I was I was delighted to see the Solicitor General's office and your argument in particular, such a staunch defense of a statute that I knew you thought had constitutional problems.
But I think that's the obligation, and I think that it is. Ed Whalen had a posting on National Review online where he said he thought it. He doesn't agree with me that there are constitutional doubts about don't ask, don't tell, the president could say. But he does like the idea that if the president had the Department of Justice change positions and do so forthrightly, that is, it ensures that you won't get a weak argument put before the court, that the court will in that circumstance be looking to someone else. They'll be appointing someone who will come in and from an actually strongly supportive position make the best arguments that can be made, and I think the adversarial system benefits from that. I don't think the president has to be the one to make those.
But whom does that counsel represent? That's the problem.
I don't think it's a problem. Therein is an amicus curiae in that case, and the adversity comes from the fact that the president, in any of these cases, the president said he's going to continue to comply with the law. And therefore, you know, people are going to be discharged if contrary to the president's suggestion, the law is upheld.
Yeah, and in the state context, the appointed counsel would be representing the people of the state that adopted the initiative. They don't meet the particularized injury harm to get standing on their own, but standing in the shoes of the state to defend an initiative of the state when the attorney general of the state or the governor of the state would not, would seem to give that the necessary standing. And I think you get a more honest read out of the courts when you have that adversarial process and you get rid of a lot of the temptation for the manipulation of the judicial process.
No, and I agree with that. It's just that I'm troubled because on the standing issue, as you know, Justice Scalia has dumped on the standard of the Warren Court years, which was precisely that. Right. Do you have sufficient adversarialness, not whether you had an actual case or controversy? And I think in some of these cases, you might be appointing a party or if you have an amicus where you really don't have proper standing.
Well,
right. I agree. There could be a serious standing problem. Now, that is solved in, for example, in the ask, don't tell, if the president would appeal and say that he's going to abide by the judgment of the court. The plaintiffs are going to, he's just going to tell the court what he honestly thinks, and then the court can hear from amicus. I mean, it's happened a lot. My colleague at O'Melveny & Myers, William T. Coleman, argued Bob Jones University in defense of the IRS's denial of tax exemption to Bob Jones after the Department of Justice concluded in President Reagan's terms that it felt that denial of the benefit by the IRS to contributors to Bob Jones was unjustified and indefensible. You know, they appointed outside counsel to argue for that position. So it's happened.
Yeah, and then you get the adversarial process that is necessary for our system to work. And I think what's driving the concerns right now is that honest effort to ensure that the adversarial process is fulfilled is not happening in some very significant cases, and we end up with rulings that have not been fully vetted through that process. And the rulings themselves are suspect, and the credibility of the judiciary ends up being online, not just the credibility of the executive that would decline to enforce. And I guess that's the concern, and trying to find out how to negotiate that line. And one of them is, and Professor Baker and I have had this discussion before, I think Article 3 gives a broader standing than Justice Scalia thinks. We'll continue to have that fight. I think it's the courts are meet in law and in equity, and the particularized harm element was never an element of an equity court in deciding things. If you had a harm, whether it was particularized or not, and that may be sufficient to get us there. But I also think appointing somebody to stand in the shoes of the government, where there's no question that the government itself would have standing, it can be used to provide the necessary standing to give the courts jurisdiction. So, but that you end up within the adversarial process fully vindicated when the particular office holders at the moment disagree with the proposition being taken.
You know, a lot of this seems to work, or at least potentially work, if the executive has tipped his hand and says his heart's not in it. John Eastman's also getting to this perfunctory defense, and I'm not sure it works then, where there's at least some sort of defense of the statute by the executive, but not a zealous defense. Is there a mechanism for the court to perceive that and do anything about that itself?
The court, in some instances, if particularly groups that support the position that they fear is being tepidly defended by the government officials, and file amicus briefs, they can request argument time, and sometimes the court will agree to that. For example, in the question of whether the Second Amendment was incorporated and applied to the states, the McDonald case, even though the advocate leading the challenge, Alan Gurub, did an excellent job. He whipped me in the Heller versus D.C. Previous case. He was principally arguing a privilege and immunities claim, and the court really wanted to hear a different argument. So they were perfectly happy to do something they almost never do, which is to give an amicus party argument time. In this case, it was the NRA, and they were represented by Paul Clement, that the justices think is one of the best advocates out there, and the NRA wrote a, you know, incorporation of the Second Amendment due process liberty brief, which was what the court was, you know, sort of interested in focusing on, and they gave argument time to Paul Clement, and what you had was a very, very good three-way argument. So the court knows how to do this. It's not that Alan Gurub wasn't giving a strong defense. He was just using a different theory than the court wanted to hear.
What happens, Walter, if there's a loss at the district court level and the government decides not to appeal?
Well, see, that's where I think, to me, that's where I think and have said publicly that the Obama administration has really no choice but to appeal the loss, the don't ask, don't tell in the district court, because otherwise what you're doing is allowing the president to basically just say, I'm not going to comply with the law. Well, as long as somebody can find one federal judge somewhere in the country who will rule against the law, then I can just say I'm not going to appeal. That can't be right. If it's not one of those rare cases where the president can say this is so clearly unconstitutional, I'm not going to comply with it, or he's doing it merely to get a test.
Particularly several appellate courts have upheld it previously.
Exactly, when appellate courts have gone the other way, you can't. And one of the, I was on the Rachel Maddow show, and with and the question is being asked, well, why isn't it terrible for the president to appeal this? He's supposed to be against don't ask, don't tell. Why would he appeal a ruling against it? And I said, well, imagine that it's 4 years hence, and it's the health care law, and it's the individual mandate that's finally gone into effect, and the president doesn't care for the law, but it's the law on the books, and they can't get a repeal through Congress, right? And one district judge is found to rule it unconstitutional. The president can't say, well, that's it. I'm not going to appeal. I mean, we all have to remember these process matters cut both ways, or at least they ought to. What's, you know, sauce for the goose is sauce for the gander, and everybody needs to keep that in mind. It's never just the issue that is immediately before you that is resolved as a precedential matter in these cases.
Yep, and yet that is exactly the scenario that has played out in the Proposition 8 litigation out in California. A single federal trial-level judge ruled Proposition 8 unconstitutional with active cooperation with the plaintiffs and the Attorney General of the state, and the Attorney General of the state declined to appeal, and there's now a significant issue on whether the proponents of the initiative have standing to pursue the appeal on their own. And if the Ninth Circuit or the Supreme Court holds that they do not, that trial-level court ruling, despite existing Supreme Court precedent to the contrary, would be binding, and that's where the concern about manipulation comes in, and how we do that, whether we hold the Attorney General to exercising the duty, as I think the Department of Justice in the Don't Ask, Don't Tell case properly filed, you know, is there a mechanism that would force the Attorney General to fulfill that duty? Or do we instead recognize that the real parties in interest, the proponents of the initiative, or in a federal statute or a state statute, the Congress or the state legislature, ought to have standing to defend their own handiwork because they're the ones that had both the views on constitutionality and the vested interest on policy grounds to see that it's vigorously enforced?
But, John, if the people turn around and elect the Attorney General who's willing to enforce the law, even though the judgment is final, and he has not been, you'd have to look at the wording of the injunction, assuming there's an injunction, he could raise the issue again, and so he would be the defendant in a suit,
well,
and
no,
the issue would eventually
sure.
go.
Whether a subsequently elected officer could say, I'm going to not abide by a single district court, I'm going to tell clerks in other districts, you know, not to ignore it. That's a sort of complex question of state law, but I'll tell you what I think what is a disputed. If you got a decision out of any other case in that circuit, that from Arizona, Nevada, Washington, Oregon, whatever, or even a judgment of a court, perhaps of another court of appeals, a different political administration could go in under Rule 60B, a federal rule that allows you to reopen an ongoing injunction,
right.
a continuing injunction, and say, we don't believe that this injunction actually accurately reflects what the law is, particularly in light of a recent decision, you know, out of the state of Arizona that's pertinent to it. So,
depending on who the... I mean, a lot of times people don't pay attention to the actual wording of the judgment. And for years in Louisiana, everybody was holding an abeyance when there was an injunction against one DA. It had no legal impact on anybody else. They just gave it respect. So I don't know what the judgment in Prop 8 says, but it might be conceivable that some other official at the local level might even be able to put it in a posture to challenge it. I don't know, John. You would know better.
Yeah, no, this one was very broad, and they were named as defendants in their official capacity, so that injunction will apply to their successors in office as well. If you had a Supreme Court ruling in a case that came up from a different federal court district that went the other direction, then you could move to lift the injunction. But you have a existing Supreme Court precedent on the precise issues that they've ignored. And that's what makes it so troubling. And I thought Walter described the issue very well at the beginning, that one of the elements on the judgment call here in the exercise of discretion is a good sense that the Supreme Court would agree that the law is unconstitutional. When you've got governing Supreme Court precedent, it's not for the local official or the trial court judge to say, well, we think the law has trended away from that precedent. If the precedent remains valid and viable, I don't see how it's anything other than a dereliction of duty not to raise those issues in trying to defend it. And that's what's gotten us into the conundrum. And I'm now looking for procedural mechanisms that would make sure that political officials pursuing policy issues would not be able to manipulate the judicial process and the judicial system in the way that's gone on here.
Well, thank you all. This has been very interesting and very educational. I appreciate your participation, Walter Dellinger, John Baker, and John Eastman. To our audience, thank you for listening. We hope you've enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For related materials to this podcast, including Walter Dellinger's op-ed and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.